So we do start off in the book of Exodus, which in some sense is really not a whole new book. It's just chapter 2 in a 5-chapter book. As we've been talking about going through the Pentateuch, certainly Exodus being a part of that. It's even interesting. Most of our English Bibles start off with, now these are the names, you know, in Exodus 1:1, but in Hebrew it actually starts with an and, which is kind of a weird way to start, but I think, if anything, it just tells us that we're just continuing where we left off in Genesis. And so, once again, keep that within its scope. But at the same time, it really does seem to be a distinct unit within that, and so it's good to think about, okay, Exodus as a whole. So I think just to start off would be a good idea for all of us to, I mean, we know Exodus, but to think again and remind ourselves what is in the book of Exodus, just even content-wise, maybe themes, purposes, those kinds of things. So when you think of Exodus, what do you think of? Moses. Good. Absolutely. What else? The plagues. The 10 plagues. Good. Exiting Egypt. The Passover. Let my people go. Good. What else?
Ten commandments.
Good. So now we're moving past the first part of the book. We have the 10 commandments. Sinai. Mount Horeb. Right? Good. Good. Yes, there is a good deal of complaining in Exodus 2. Yes, yes, that's true. Good. How does the book end? Anyone remember? Good. You got it. Very good. The tabernacle. The book ends with the building of the tabernacle, the laws regarding the tabernacle, and ultimately Yahweh's presence coming and filling the tabernacle with glory. Good. So those are some of the major themes of this book. You think of the power of God. You think of the presence of God. You think of the people of God. If I were to kind of... What's that? There you go, the three P's. You know, if I were to kind of put a summary onto this book, I think of it as the formation of the nation of Israel. That's really what this is about. God in his sovereign power. You know, you start off the book kind of just continuing off of Genesis with 70 people. You skip quite a few years and you end up with this multitude of people in Egypt. And that's kind of how the book starts off, obviously. And God, by his power, redeems them out of Egypt, delivers them with a mighty right hand. Obviously, the Pharaoh and the plagues and all of that you see there. So he forms this people for himself. He brings them to Mount Sinai, gives them the Ten Commandments, as was said, you know, enters into this covenantal relationship with them there, where the Ten Commandments and really the law as a whole becomes the, the constitution of the nation of Israel, right? Where, you know, God says, I will, you know, all the way back in Genesis, obviously, we have the Abrahamic promises and these eternal promises that God is going to accomplish his plan through the descendant of Abraham. But then that's through the nation of Israel. And if you will, the laws, that contract for how that's going to be brought about. Israel, if you obey me, I will bless you and I will exalt you above all the nations, and all the nations will look to you. And so you see a lot of those themes, the themes of God's holiness, God's power, God's law. And then, as Eric was saying, it ends with the tabernacle, God's presence. You know, and obviously that even God's holiness there as well. And so I think when I think about it, it's, you know, Genesis is kind of God's plan laid out, and now we're starting to see it brought into fulfillment through the nation of Israel. And so we see God form this nation that is going to be so instrumental in terms of his plan to bring about blessing to the world. And obviously all of God's plans center around Israel. I think I left out one other theme that you see within Exodus. We talked about the power of God, you know, in the plagues and all those, but you also see this cosmic battle, if I could put it that way, between Yahweh and the gods of Egypt. And, you know, in one sense, it's between Moses and Pharaoh, but in another sense, it's bigger than that. And so it really traces its theme all the way back to Genesis and this good and evil kind of a theme that we saw all the way back there. And then the serpent, you know, and good and evil, and the enmity between the serpent's line and the the woman's line. And so in some senses, that kind of comes to, I don't know if I'll say culmination, but you get a real sense of Pharaoh being this wicked man, just opposed to God's people, opposed to God's plan. And ultimately, as we see here, it's not just Pharaoh. I mean, Pharaoh himself was somewhat looked at as a god in Egypt, but it's even the demonic forces that you see Yahweh battling against in the book of Exodus as well. And so you see God's power, his sovereignty, his plan prevailing. I love that kind of, if I could put it that way, that cosmic, universal, you know, the whole universe is engaged in this kind of battle between good and evil, and Yahweh wins. And so it's pretty cool to look at it from that perspective as well. All right, anything else as you think about Exodus? There's obviously, as you said, just Moses being the central figure. You know, we've looked at a lot of different characters from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, but Moses now enters onto the scene, and tonight we'll see his calling. We'll see God setting him apart, and obviously he's the central figure in the rest of the Pentateuch, and just how he really is the deliverer. Ultimately, the deliverer is God, but God, in a unique way, uses Moses to bring about his plan and purpose. And you see what obviously, even throughout the whole rest of Scripture, Moses is kind of just such a central figure because of how God uses him in such an amazing way to bring about his plan and his purpose. So it's exciting to walk through it, to think through, watch what God is doing. And once again, as we said, as God is, keep it in perspective, what God's plan is it's to form this nation by his power, by his plan, to be the one who is keeping his law, who are in a covenant relationship with him, so that as they obey and they, you know, do what God wants them to do, that they will be blessed by him, and all the other nations will look to Israel as the center of God's plan and purpose. And all the other nations of the world will see just what God is doing through them. And so once again, keep that global perspective in mind as we walk through this book. Okay? So I think those are some of the major themes and purposes as we dive into Exodus. Come on in. We just kind of did a quick running look at some of the themes in Exodus. So
sorry, we showed up the wrong house.
Oh, sorry about that.
Luckily, somebody was there though, so we just followed them.
So we just looked at some of the major themes, and we're going to dive into the first few chapters of Exodus here, just as we see this story unfold. So turn with me to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. So obviously these first seven verses kind of tie directly to what we've seen in Genesis and pick up where we left off with these 70 descendants of Jacob who came to Israel, and it kind of reminds us of the 12 tribes and who they were. And once again, just the continuity there. And as we'll see as we walk through here, it does tie back to Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant, that God has a plan for his people. And so we start off there. And even just remember, as we talked about earlier, it's kind of interesting how the author kind of, in one sense, works it out so that it's an even number of 70 here. And even how he said there's a 70... he worked out the table of nations to have 70 different nations. And in Deuteronomy, it mentions how that God apportioned the nations according to the number of the sons of Israel. And it gives us that perspective that God is working in the world, right? And that Israel is God's vehicle to bring about blessing to the world. And so that 70 is kind of a number that triggers that theme and that thought. And so, of course, they come to Egypt and all of that generation dies out. But, verse 7, the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. And just a reminder that, of course, this is God's chosen nation. He has said he will bless them. It goes all the way back to Noah, you know, being fruitful and multiply, and Adam and Eve. And you see God's blessing on his people. And as we talked about just briefly in kind of our introduction here, that's going to be despite the cosmic battle and despite Pharaoh trying to oppose God and his plan, God is still going to prevail. And God's blessing will still be on his people because he has promised to bless the seed of Abraham. And so that's what we see starting in verse 8. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, and their labors which they rigorously opposed on them. So you see just the fierce opposition that Pharaoh has to God's people. And in spite of that, the message is God is still blessing. They are his chosen people. And so in spite of the hardships, in spite of the trouble, they're multiplying and they're growing because God's blessing is upon them. And you just see that it continues on. There's so much irony in these initial chapters here that the more Pharaoh tries to do to stamp out God's people, the more God's plan prevails in spite of him. And so that's the message throughout here is ultimately the Pharaoh and all his army is going to be wiped out because God prevails. But you just see over and over God's plan is the one that's prevailing in spite of this king. And so kind of plan A doesn't work for, you know, plan A was, okay, I know how to, you know, get these Israelites to kind of get under our rule and make sure that they're not greater than us. Let's oppress them. So they try that. That doesn't work. So let's move to plan B. And so verse 15, then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sifra and the other was named Puah. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them. And so God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. So I should have maybe kept verse 22 for the next section, because that's plan C. But obviously he has this plan. Okay, so the oppression didn't work. The forced labor, the hard work didn't really work to kind of dwindle the people of Israel. So we'll kill them off with the midwives. And so he gives this plan to these two midwives. Probably they were maybe like the chief midwives, because for a nation of this size, I don't think two midwives can, you know, deliver babies for a million people or however many there were at this point. And so, but they feared God. And it's just an amazing statement of their faith that these two women opposed the edict of Pharaoh. And you watch through this section, it's a series of brave women who fear God, who oppose Pharaoh and his plan, and who it's ironic, you know, that these two lowly midwives are the ones that undermine Pharaoh's plan and work. God works through them to accomplish his plan. And obviously Moses' mother and Moses' sister, you know, and all these, God uses a series of women to oppose Pharaoh, the most mighty man on the earth. And once again, it's God's plan overruling Pharaoh's plan. It's good triumphing over evil and God's sovereignty overruling the plans of wicked men. And so God blesses the midwives And so Pharaoh has to move on to plan three, because once again, verse 20, the people are multiplying and become very mighty, right? And Pharaoh's plan isn't working. So verse 22, then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. And so he kind of elevates it. Now he's kind of trying to, you know, the Israelites are living among the Egyptians, and so now he's kind of turning the whole nation against them and seeking, you know, to kind of create all his people into informants and those who will actually enact this command because of just his opposition of God's people. But of course, now we kind of enter into an interlude, because even through that command, and in one sense, because of that command, God is actually going to bring about his deliverer, Moses. And so I forgot one of the key women that God uses in this whole plan. Who is the other woman whom we didn't mention? The princess, right? Pharaoh's daughter and him herself is used to bring about this plan to deliver and to oppose Pharaoh's plan. How ironic is that? Right? His own daughter is the one who is used by God to overturn his plan to oppress and to put down and to oppose God and his people. And so we start off in chapter 2 kind of an aside, if you will, and we narrow in once again on what God is doing in a seemingly insignificant event, you know, the birth of one child, that God is going to use so mightily to bring about this great deliverance. And so we start off in chapter 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a wicker basket and covered it with tar and pitch. Then she put the child in to it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside of the Nile, and she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you that from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you? Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go ahead. So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. It's just an amazing story, right? How ironic is that? You understand the irony of that? Not only is Pharaoh's daughter the one that saves the one who's going to be the deliverer of Israel, but even more than that, she pays her own mother to nurse the child. It's so ironic that it's beautiful and how God's sovereignty works out, that here the mother of the child gets to raise the child and even gets paid for it because of the king's edict. And you just see how God is working so clearly through the scenes to bring about his plan. He's obviously so clearly in control here. And so obviously Moses is born. And so we fast forward. In verse 11, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. I mean, we don't know exactly how many years later, but maybe as many as 40 years later, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw that there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And he went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. So you kind of have these two parallel incidents here. First, Moses comes upon an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, and you know, however it was, probably through the influence of his mother, but it seems that he's very clearly understands his Hebrew roots. He seems to have clearly, even though being raised as Pharaoh's daughter, he seems to really have identified himself with God's people, and he understood who he was, even though he was in this high position. And so he sees this this Egyptian beating this Hebrew, and a sense of righteous anger wells up for in him, and even murders and kills this Egyptian. Because once again, he saw him striking a Hebrew. But you can't really see the wordplay, but then he sees a Hebrew striking another Hebrew. And so he has such an identity with his people that that doesn't make any sense to him. This is your brother. These are your people. Why would you strike your own brother? But of course, you see that Moses isn't accepted at this point. And it kind of sets the stage, if you will, for what's going to happen. His years off in Midian, where he will receive the call of God. And ultimately, I think one of the lessons from this is, you know, as Moses, in one sense, tried to bring this about on his own, he wasn't ultimately successful. It wasn't until God called him that his mission was going to be successful to deliver the people of Israel. And so I think that's one of the functions of this. Certainly, it was going to be in God's timing and God's way that God was going to bring Moses to the man, to be the man he wanted to be, to bring him in and bring about this deliverance. And this wasn't God's timing, and this wasn't God's way. And so you kind of see the contrast where even this, you know, this Israel, his Jewish brother said, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us?" And it's kind of ironic because at this point, no one had, right? At this point, no one had. But in the near future, when God is going to call him and send him and give him his commission and give him his purpose, then at that point he could say, God did. God is the one that has sent me to you to deliver you. But at this point, it hadn't happened yet. And so it's a reminder that it's got to be according to God's plan and God's way. And he has to wait for God's timing. And so, of course, verse 15, Pharaoh hears the matter. And so Moses has to flee to Midian. And so we come in, and so Moses is now in Midian, and he comes across these these daughters of this priest of Midian, and they're trying to water their flock, but there's these shepherds that basically kind of came and oppressed these daughters of this Midian priest. But Moses stood up and helped them, kind of stands up once again for righteousness, I guess you could say, and helps these women. And it's interesting, the statement that's made here, when it says, verse 19, "So they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds." That word "delivered" is really the word that runs throughout the Exodus of God's mighty deliverance, God's great salvation. And so you see Moses, even at an early point, it's kind of a word play. I think it kind of signals us to the fact that Moses is God's chosen deliverer. And that's who he is in God's divine plan. And it reminds us of that at this early point. And so basically, you know what happens. Moses marries one of these daughters, becomes his wife, and he, you know, is living as a shepherd for his father, for his father-in-law. And in verse 22, he bears his son Gershom, for he says, "I've been a sojourner in a foreign land." Okay, any questions up to that point? Certainly we're just walking through the narrative and watching as we watch it unfold. Just, I think, just be encouraged again by seeing how God's sovereignty, just as we read through the stories in Genesis and we read those familiar stories, let the newness of the fact that, and be amazed once again at what God did through seemingly insignificant events, through God's timing, through God's plan, how he accomplishes his purpose. No, that is a question that the commentators bring up. I think it's because, and this would be kind of my answer to it, that at this point, you kind of can see Pharaoh probably knows as well Moses' identity. And so at that point, he's sided with Pharaoh's enemies. And you're kind of in danger of a coup, you know, if you will, or of an uprising. You know, and especially if one of his own sons, you know, in one sense, is siding with these with these Hebrew slaves, I think that that's the, in Pharaoh's mind, that's the whole danger that he's, you know, from the very beginning that he's afraid of, is that is the Israelis will rise up against him. And so I think especially with a man like Moses, who's been raised in the court, you know, when he sees him siding with his people against the Egyptians, this is maybe somewhat conjectural, but I think he could see the potential for an uprising, you know, and just in terms of Moses being the leader of that. And that's indeed what happened, but not in the way that you might think, right? As God in his timing brings about Moses to bring about this deliverance. I think different Pharaoh, but I mean that the one Pharaoh continues the aggression of the first, you know. So at some point, you know, at the very beginning of this, there's obviously a number of generations that pass, and so when it says then a Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph, it's probably not just, you know, the Pharaoh right after the one in Joseph's day, because there's a number of years that have passed there. And I'm not going to get into all the chronology of it, because I want to stick more with the story of Exodus. But that's pretty fascinating to get into the details of the chronology as well. Right. Yep. Exactly. You kind of deal with the number of pharaohs throughout Exodus. But yeah, it's good.
I don't see it kind of being a, not comical. I mean, obviously God has hand in the whole thing, but Moses' mom just decides to make this little ark, and I'm going to stick my baby and let it just float down the river. You know, it's like, let's hope it doesn't sink or drown. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know it doesn't give any detail exactly as why, but it's just kind of funny.
Well, there's a lot of irony in that, because first of all, what was Pharaoh's command? Throw the babies into the river, right? So that's somewhat ironic even there. Plus, you know... But also you saw that she put him in the reeds, and so the purpose of that being that he wouldn't float downstream, you know, so he would kind of be, you know, in the river but not, you know, downstream. And then even there is somewhat interesting, because the word for this, I don't know what it says here, this little boat or whatever, it's the same word for ark that we say even in Noah's day. It's just a reminder, like, you know, that God is the one, like, whether it's in Noah's ark or in Moses' ark, you know, you could talk to people now about Moses' ark and they'll think you're confused, but no, Moses had an ark. So, but it reminds us of God is the one that preserves and saves. I think even that may be part of the reason why the same word is used, because just as with Noah's ark, where God is the one that, you know, in the midst of this massive flood is preserving, you know, it's kind of the same thought, right? You put your baby in this little wicker basket, you know, it really is your trust in God at that point. Because as you say, that doesn't seem like the safest place to put a little baby. But, yeah, it's good questions.
Is there any sense that at this time that any of the, that they knew that he was Hebrew?
Who, the Egyptians?
Moses. No, that the Hebrews knew that Moses was...
That's a good question.
Because now, you know, when particularly when the two mm-hmm. Hebrews are fighting, you know, accusing him of killing the Egyptian, you know, was he, you know, you would think that, well, boy, he's on our side.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's like, do they or don't they know?
That's a good question. I mean... There's, as far as I could tell, there's no indication in the text that'd be any different than we see here. I was kind of assuming, because of what you just said about him murdering the Egyptian, that they would kind of see that, and probably obviously his family knew, and so I would, you know, would have thought that they would have known that, but there's really no explicit mention of that. So that's somewhat conjectural. But it's a good question, you know. You would think that they would be like, all right, Moses standing up for his people, you know, and all that, but they didn't recognize him. And ultimately, as we'll see, it's going to be God, the one that's going to have to show them, and just by his signs. And there, ultimately, as we get to the end of the section of here, it's going to talk about that the people believed. They believed because they understood that God had indeed sent Moses. in light of some of the signs he performed and all of that. So I think for me at least, it's a reminder that it really takes God's power, God's call, God's commission, God's plan for it to work out. And that's kind of how I'd see that story functioning there, is as a reminder to us, because then Moses is going to go, God's going to call him, God's going to empower him, and then the people will believe. And then God will use him to confront Pharaoh and the Exodus, and you know how the story goes. That's good. Now, verses 23 through 25 are key, because, well, you'll see why. Notice what it says. Now, it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of the their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. There's four different words there for the trouble and the affliction that kind of represents the trouble and the affliction of the Israelites. You'll see that they had their groaning, their sighs, their bondage. They cried out. You know, they're being heavily oppressed, and so they cry out to God. And notice there's four verbs of God's response. God heard, God remembered, God saw, and God took notice. Right? So they're crying out to God. And these words here, they kind of run throughout some of this section. God remembers. God takes notice. God cares for his people. It's the idea that God saw. It's the idea that God knew, that God remembered. You know, he cares for his people. He knows what's going on. And so it's easy to forget that this had been going on for a very, very long time, this affliction by these pharaohs. You know, I mean, these people have been, they built up these massive cities and the Egyptian taskmasters and the affliction and the hardship. I mean, we can't really, it's hard to imagine for us what kind of oppression they were under. You know, I mean, I think to some degree, maybe you could compare it with American slavery. I don't know how similar it was, but you know, at least maybe that helps us to get a picture in our minds of the kind of oppression. We kind of read it as a Sunday school story and we forget how horribly difficult this would have been. And so they cry out to God and God remembers. He cares for his people. But it's a reminder that he doesn't always act instantly like we would like him to. But in his time, just where it's the other time that this key phrase of God remembered, you remember happens all the way back in Genesis with the flood, God remembered Noah. When God remembers, he remembers his promise and he acts on behalf of his people. And so here, so key, he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He knew, he remembers the promises that he had made to his people. And so now, this is kind of like the turning point, in a sense, of the whole narrative. Now God's going to act. Now God, Yahweh, is going to come out in power and do something about this. And you know that his power is just going to come and completely overpower the Egyptians. Because he remembers, he will be faithful to his word. And so it's kind of a cool turning point in a sense that, yes, they are afflicted, but now is the time that God is going to remember, he's going to keep his word, and he's going to act in power on behalf of his people. And so immediately what happens? You know, Moses is pasturing, and verse 2, the angel of Yahweh appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. We all know the story of the burning bush and the angel of Yahweh himself, which we've seen all throughout Genesis that we've talked about before, that messenger of Yahweh himself that's often equated with Yahweh, who comes on behalf of Yahweh and in one sense as Yahweh, as a messenger to give God's message. And so Moses, of course, says, I must turn aside and see this marvelous sight. You know, he's like, huh, that's kind of interesting. Let me go over there and see what's going on as he goes. And when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to look, verse 4, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Yahweh said, I have surely seen, once again, and that's very emphatic, I've certainly or surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I've given heed, right? He's noticed, he's visited them. He's seen what's going on. He's going to act on their behalf. Their cry because of their taskmasters. I'm aware. I know their sufferings. Right? That word know runs throughout. You know, you can't necessarily see it in the English, but God is aware. He knows. And that has to do with his, not just his head knowledge, if you will, but his experiential knowledge where he knows what's going on. And so I have come down to deliver them. You know, that great word deliverance once again, from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and a spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression which the Egyptians are oppressing. So you see those terms once again. I've seen, I've heard, and so God is going to act. And so what's God's plan? Verse 10, therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. So that's God's plan, right? I am sending you to be the deliverer. But now what's going to happen? You have a series of, in one sense, objections. The first of these, at some point, the last one we know is Moses went too far. I think I would probably say that the first of these objections are somewhat legitimate. He's probably speaking out of humility. Certainly we could tell by the last one, by God's response, that he has gone too far and finally says, Moses, just go. My paraphrase. But, you know, initially Moses, I think, has a sense of the awesomeness of this task. And so he says, God, he asks a series of questions like, how is this going to be? And so God lays out the plan to Moses. And so, yeah, please. Sure.
Did God wait for people to grow before he did something?
Yeah, I mean...
Because I read back, and it doesn't say anywhere that they grow. It just says that the Egyptians made their life hard.
Right.
So this is the first time they actually say anything to God, and this is the first time that God takes action to deliver them.
Right, and I would say that is... I mean, it seems to be an inference, a clear inference from the narrative, yes, that it's in response to their cry that God now is going to act. Yeah, I would agree with that. That's kind of what I was, in one sense, trying to say, that, I mean, they're crying out, and it's a plea for help to God, and God remembers and he acts. And so it does seem to be in response to that. That's a great question. Had done so earlier, maybe, who knows, you know? Yeah, it's a good reminder, just prayer.
Apparently he knew all about it all along.
Yeah.
Well, in Genesis, do they say your people are going to be...
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, so there's both sides of it. As Charity's saying, even back in Genesis, they had been prophesied, like, you know, to Abraham, here's the plan. You know, I'm going to send your people down to Egypt, and they're going to be in bondage, cruel bondage, for 400 years, and then I'm going to bring them back out again. So there's both sides of it, where it was part of God's plan that they're in bondage that many years, but at the same time, in answer to their prayer at the right time, God brings them out. So I think both sides of it are true. That's good. Good observations. And so Moses' first question, verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And so I think that's a legitimate question, you know. I think it's probably motivated by his humility. You know, who am I? Can't necessarily interpret his motives, but certainly God answers him and he says, certainly I will be with you, right? That's a great statement just in and of itself. The presence of God is what empowers and enables God's people to accomplish God's plan and purpose. God says, I will be with you. And that, as we said, that's a major theme of this book. Just the presence of God is what enables people to accomplish God's will. And so that's a great statement. And then he also says, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Now that is one of the toughest verses to interpret, because you're like, wait a minute. How is that a sign? Don't I want a sign before I get to Egypt? Like, that confirms me and says, you know, Moses, you're the one. How are you to know the one? Well, when you get onto the other side of it, this is what's going to happen. It's like, wait, I kind of wanted the sign ahead of time so I would know that I'm supposed to be the one. So a lot of people have kind of wrestled with this, and they're like, well, really the sign is the burning bush or this or that. I would probably lean towards the fact that the sign is one that requires faith even in and of itself. And so it's kind of a sign that in one sense is retroactive, I guess, where God gives him this prophecy that ultimately he has faith in that is the sign. And it's kind of an interesting sign, but some of the other signs he'll give him are more tangible firsthand. But even there, that is a major theme of this book. You shall worship God at this mountain. I haven't brought it out yet, but throughout the book, even thus far, I could show, you know, different places where it occurs. But there's this idea that the Israelites served the king of Egypt. That's the word. You know, they served him. They're in bondage to him. They're slaves. They're servants. They served him. But, and that's the word that's here. You shall serve God at this mountain. And there's this, part of the idea here is we'll walk through this narrative and through the plagues. What you'll see is God says, let my people go so that they may serve and worship me. We talked about this book in summary is the formation of a nation. We can insert into that. It's a formation of a worshiping nation. That's really the message of this book, that God by his power forms a nation to be a nation that obeys his laws, keeps his commandments, is in covenantal relationship to him. That's a worshiping nation, that God's presence is with them. And so then all the nations of the world would see Israel as they are this worshiping nation. And so there's kind of that implication that God frees them from bondage to Pharaoh for what? For bondage to him. And that really is the message, right? Freed from his service to serve God. And so, you know, very New Testament. You know, the New Testament picks up on that.
Very much like what Paul says, that we are a slave to sin, but we should be returned to be a slave to Christ.
Exactly. And it's very much a similar theme. And it's kind of, you know, God frees them from this bondage. And it really, you think of it, that really the only liberty that you can have is in service to God. You know, that it's only in service to him that there is true freedom. It's kind of the enigma of it, yeah?
Freedom and blessing.
Yeah, exactly. The blessing, the freedom, the, you know, on and on it goes. Yeah, it's a great, great thought. And really the thought that, you know, they can only serve one or the other, ultimately. And so God redeems them from the one so that they could serve and worship him as part of his plan. And we'll see that theme that runs throughout this whole book. That over and over, they say, Pharaoh, we got to leave so that we could go and serve and worship God. So that we could, and they use other terms like service or worship or sacrifice, but they all entail that same thought of worshiping and serving and doing that for God. And so there's kind of a play there that I think like 100 times that idea of service runs throughout this book. And it's contrasting service to Pharaoh to service to God.
Is it accurate to say that Moses isn't really asking, like, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He's really asking about himself. And so God gives him, verse 12, kind of reassurance as to whether or not this is a dumb choice. He says, later you'll know if you trust and have faith now, in the future your faith will be confirmed.
Yep.
Or, I'm not sure if I caught it, like, because then later he says, well, what if the people say? Because initially he goes, well, what about me? You know, how am I supposed to know? And then later he says, well, what if the people don't think so? Is that correct? He's starting with himself and saying, well, how am I supposed to know I'm the right dude? And then Moses says, well, how are they going to know I'm the right dude? Is that the right sequence?
Yeah, pretty much. And you'll see that Moses keeps asking questions that in one sense revolve around him, and God keeps bringing the answers back that revolves around him being God. And so Moses is like, how do I, you know, what about me? And God says, I will be with you. It's all about me, Moses. You know, and what about, how will the people know? And God says, well, I'll tell you who I am, right? And so there's a lot of I's in this passage. You know, Moses is like, what about me? And God says, well, let me tell you about me. And so you see God's answer to that. And once again, you think about the life of Moses, this, if you want to call it his commissioning, is really that which gives him a sense of the awesomeness of God that's going to strengthen him throughout his ministry, that he really wants to be sure about this before he goes and does what he's about to do, right? And so that's why I would say that probably in my mind, the first few of these questions are legitimate questions that God answers. And it's like, hey, let me give you that assurance. Let me give you that confidence. Let me give you that conviction that you could stand on for this ministry. But then at the end, the last one, God gets mad at him and is like, all right, Moses, you've gone too far. Just go. You know, and so we'll see it play out.
I got a question that's kind of brewing in my head. And I've never really thought about this, but Joseph and Jacob were, and Isaac, as a matter of fact, they were, shall we say, they were all reared in Jewish homes. So they have been taught since they were infants about who God was. Is this supposed to be Moses' primary encounter with God that starts his journey? I mean, if he's being raised in Pharaoh's household, whether it's rightly under Pharaoh or just, shall we say, with the women of the household, you know, he's being schooled in a lot of unrighteous religious stuff, you know, whatever. So
it's a good question. I there's not real no real good way to answer it, because it's a question. The question that you're asking is a question that a lot of people ask, commentators and what have you. And I tend to think that he had when it says that his mother reared him and nursed him and all that kind of stuff, that tends to be a lot older age than we would consider weaning. You know, they didn't wean at like 1 year old. That would be maybe like 5 or 6.
Right. She's a long-term nanny to him.
Right. And so he could have, in one sense, had somewhat of a solid foundation. You know, how old was he when he was finally turned over, you know, to Pharaoh's daughter? We don't know, but he certainly had some, I would say, seems to me, basis. So I don't know how much he knew, but at least it's kind of conjectural, but it seems to me that he had a pretty good sense of his people and who they were, and in one sense, who he was. Yeah.
Acts 7 kind of lends a lot of credence to what you're saying, because when Stephen's given his spiel before the council in verse 20, it was this time Moses was born. He was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's house. And after, so he was 3 months in his father's home, and then he gets tossed in the river in the basket. He was educated in all the learning of Egypt, but when the time was approaching the age of 40, it entered into his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him, took vengeance, and oppressed for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. So he had an understanding, like, these are my brethren, and he even thought that they're going to understand that God's raising me up to deliver them, but they didn't get it at the time. Mm-hmm. And then in Hebrews, you even have the passage that says he counted basically the afflictions of Christ as being more worth more than the whole treasure of the house of Pharaoh. And so I think there was a lot of understanding in Moses' mind of who he was.
And that's good. Good. Thanks for sharing that. It's good.
I have the same struggle as that was shared earlier. Is this a conversion experience then or not? And you answer, you don't know, but if you compare it to Paul in the New Testament, when God speaks to him, his reaction to God was, you know, who are you, Lord? And immediately the Lord revealed himself to him. But in this case, you have a lot of questions going on. And earlier in the chapter, you have the phrase that the Hebrew midwives who feared God did not even question the why to do the right thing. They just didn't. So I know that we talked about the fear of God in the study the other day as almost being equal to saying they had faith.
Mm-hmm.
The women had faith in God. And here, I don't see a clear statement of Moses who feared God or who had faith in God, but instead is receiving this revelation, and all of a sudden he's like, well, why me? where my point is. And the reason I ask is because where's the application? And is the application in when we get some kind of, we know what God wants us to do. Is it okay to question them? Is it okay to say, well, you know, what if it doesn't go this way? Or
Well, I think that's the interesting part of verse 12 that I'm still sort of harping on.
Sure.
Like, you shall serve God on this mountain. That's the reward for you trusting me. So isn't that like, have faith, then I will reward you with confirmation that that faith is legitimate. Right? Have faith. And then when you bring people out, you'll serve me here. That's your reward.
Right. I think just to come back to his question, though, I mean, I tend to think that he had an understanding, kind of like what you're saying. So I wouldn't necessarily look at it as a conversion type of experience. I mean, once again, it's a narrative, and so we kind of just read it, and certainly at the end of it, God rebukes him for his final question. But I think even by the fact that God answers him and uses these signs, as we continue on, you'll see how it, you know, he says, this is what you are to say to them. This, and God, in one sense, uses these signs to bring about the confirmation that he wants to bring about. And so, that, I don't see it as a questioning God in terms of doubting, but more in like, okay, God, how are you going to bring this about? You know, I'm just a, you know, this kind of a guy. You know, I'm just, you know, how is this going to work out? I don't, you know, and so then God starts to, in the way I see it would be like, God starts to unveil, okay, here's how this is going to work. This is the plan. I'm commissioning you. I'm going to be the one that's empowering you. It's not going to be in your strength. It's going to be in mine. And so in one sense, I would see it more of like a commissioning than a, but anyway, it is just a narrative, so it's hard to answer all those questions.
One possibility that I thought of just now, as a matter of fact, you can get Abraham is told by God to sacrifice Isaac, and you don't have a narrative explaining, well, why, or can you do something else? But in this case, if indeed we believe Moses is the author of this letter,
mm-hmm.
he has a keen insight as to what he was thinking at the time.
Right.
So maybe he was able to
Add that in there. Yeah, that's good.
I think, too, if you just think about the normal human experience that we have in life, like, I was raised in the church, so as a small child, you have certain levels of knowledge, right, about God, who he is. Then you get to the age where you actually think about God and you ask yourself questions about God. And then it comes to a point, if you, as a small child, have been confirmed or baptized and go through all these, shall we say, landmarks of growing up, you could say, oh, I know I was a Christian going back till I was, you know, sixth grade or whatever. But maybe in high school and your college age, you come to different levels of commitment. And this is might be what we see in Moses. As you read at the age of 40, you know that by then he's a man. He's really thinking about who his people are, where he came from. And if we will assume natural things happen, his mother has told him about his people, how they got here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that by this point, maybe this is a, you say commissioning, that's from God's point of view, but it might be from Moses' point of view, where he's really saying, okay, you know, I'm not just a hero of the moment of the day, but I'm going to be their deliverer in God's terms, you know, coming to recognize that it's not him that's going to be doing all this work, it's God's that's going to be doing
it. I mean, certainly I think that, as I would see the 40-year interval here, where in one sense he did try to do it his way, and here God's like, okay, here's my way of doing it. Let's do it my way, Moses. And so, anyway, that's kind of how I'd see those questions. So let's walk through them, and we'll see kind of how they play out.
Hey, quick question. Just like, I would talk about conversion experience, and I'm thinking in terms of Old Testament and New Testament. New Testament, there seems to be like examples of conversion experience, but in, like in the Old Testament, it seems more like there's the growing obedience to God.
Yeah. that's a probably a bigger topic than we could touch on here. I mean, certainly we would say, I would say, that it's not identical in the sense that, you know, Old Testament saints didn't have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit in the same way, and there are some distinct differences there. But at the same time, you do have, in some sense, sometimes conversions where it's like such and such a person's like, okay, I'm going to follow Yahweh now, you know, whether it be Rahab or whoever, you know. And so, yeah, I would see some differences, but there's also maybe some similarities. But that's probably a thesis topic right there. So can't fully answer.
Why God would hold that out as a promise? You know, like there's no conversion experience here, but there is. You have faith, and there's a promise behind that faith. And the promise is, I will accomplish this if you do this and trust in me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's no like. Can't call it a conversion experience, maybe, but you could call it a definite act of, you know, willing faith.
Yeah.
I'm going to believe that you'll be accomplishing this, such that I'll worship on this mountain.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That's good. And so now, Moses' second question in verse 13. Then Moses said to God, "Behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' Now they may say to me, 'What is his name? What shall I say to them?' God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said to him, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am, has sent me to you.' God furthermore said to Moses, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations.'" Awesome section. And for those of you that are kind of familiar with this passage or even just the name Yahweh, it very much appears that the name Yahweh, the covenant name of God that we talk about that runs throughout the whole Old Testament, is very much related to this idea of I am. The verb I am is the Hebrew verb like is or to be. And when God says I am who I am, he uses that verb. Or it's even a tough section to translate. You could almost translate I will be who I will be, but it seems to me a statement of self-existence, you know, that I'm God, that's who I am. God can't be defined by anything else. And so, you know, God, what's your name? It's more of a statement of what's your character, what's your nature, rather than just, you know, oh, here's my name, let me spell it out for you. And really, when God gives his name, his revelation is, I'm the one who is. That's who I am. And that's what his name Yahweh seems to derive from. Now, that, I mean, there's, you know, once again, you want to talk about dissertations and stuff. There's a lot of ink spilled on these couple of verses here. All kinds of different theories about where that comes from. But it seems to me to be just the basic essence of it. And that Yahweh says, this is who I am. Tell the sons of Israel that I am who I am. I am sent you. You know, and that's my nature, is the one who is self-existent. And then he kind of goes in and further defines it as Yahweh, the God of your fathers, right? And he ties it all the way back to Abraham, to the covenant faithful God who has made these promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he says, this is my name forever. This is who I am for eternity, the self-existent, eternal God. And so that is the answer that you are to give these people when they question, yeah, who sent you, Moses? Like, I'll tell you who sent me. It's the eternally existent, self-existent Yahweh who is who he is, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is who has sent me. And so, that, once again, there's all kinds of debate. Is this the first time that the name Yahweh came into being? Or we certainly find Yahweh's name in Genesis. But it seems to me that really this is where it's explained for the first time, and that you really have a full sense of, okay, what does this mean? And so there's some tough questions there, because in one sense it seems like God is revealing his name for the first time here, because he's like, let me tell you what my name is. But they would have all known it already, I think. But here he's just kind of explaining it and investing it with the meaning that they may not have even known before, where that name came from.
This is this reveals the personality of God. You know, this is not
right.
The Egyptian God where some concept of an animal or something in nature represents a characteristic of a power that's beyond their control, like the weather, you know, the sun, the movement of the sun. I just recently been reading a little bit about the Egyptian life, you know, during the what we call the pyramid stages and stuff. And this is a personal encounter of God with man. You know, it's not like our New Age kind of concept of God, or just of a essence or some kind of force. Or good intentions, you know. But this is a person. God has personality, and He is meeting. He's come down to Moses on a personal level to encounter it, just like He encountered Jacob. You know, in the wrestling match.
Right.
I think that's important to keep in mind that God is not a metaphor. God is personality, and that's the God we can know. We can have our own encounters with God, not necessarily in a physically burning bush, but we do have encounters with God, and that's not something, you know, that's, we've been given that privilege through Jesus Christ.
It's a good reminder. And so he comes through here and he says, verse 16, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt and will say to him, Yahweh the God of the Hebrews has met with us. So now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God." Once again, there's that theme, right? That God's purpose of redeeming his people from Egypt so that they may sacrifice, so that they may worship him. "But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion," or literally, except by a mighty hand. "So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians." And so once again, that, you know, God says, this is my name. That's what you are to say to them, and I will use that to bring about my purpose. So what does Moses have? Another question. Then Moses said, "What if they will not believe me or listen to me? What shall I say? For they may say, Yahweh has not appeared to you." So you know what happens. Yahweh says, "All right, take your staff." And so he throws it on the ground and becomes a snake. Just God's, once again, creative power. Just omnipotent power to turn a staff into a snake. And then he puts his hand into his bosom, to his pocket or whatever, and it becomes leprous. And he puts it in again and comes back to normal. And God shows him those signs, verse 5, so that they may believe, right? That key word, that they may believe that Yahweh, the God of their fathers, has appeared to you. And so, you know, as you come through here, he does the leprosy, and these are the signs. And then, furthermore, verse 9, "If they will not believe even these two signs, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and it will turn into blood." And then Moses said to Yahweh, okay, so God says, okay, furthermore, I'll give you these miraculous signs to authenticate that you are indeed my servant. And then Moses has another request, verse 10. "Then Moses said to Yahweh, please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Yahweh said to him, who has made man's mouth, or who makes him mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, Yahweh. Now then, go. I will be, you know, literally it says, I will be with your mouth. You know, it's almost like I will, if I remember correctly there, I have to go back. I think it's like, I will be your mouth. You know, God, once again, it's the emphasis, you're worried about yourself, but it's all about me, right? You're worried about your eloquence, but it's all about my power. You're worried about how will the people know you, but it's all about me. And God keeps bringing it back to the power of Yahweh. And so he says, I will teach you what to say. And then verse 13, this is where, at least at this point, Moses crosses the line, if not earlier. Moses says, please, Lord, now send the messenger by whomever you will. In other words, it's kind of like, can you choose someone else, please? And then verse 14, then the anger of Yahweh burned against Moses. Enough, right? Enough questions, enough, you know, holding back. I'm sending you, Moses. And so he says, is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And so you know what happens. God says, you know, I'll bring Aaron, he'll be your mouthpiece. And he makes that statement that you will be like God to Aaron. You know, in other words, you'll be the one that directs his speech and he'll speak. And once again, take your staff and go. And so verse 18, Moses departs from his father-in-law. And so he goes. And so Moses takes his wife and they return with his staff in his hand. And so verse 21, Yahweh said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders or all the signs, the miracles, which I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may, what? Serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. You see, obviously, the irony, the justice in that, that God says, Israel is my firstborn son. Let him go that he may worship me, that he may serve me. But of course, Pharaoh, that kind of introduces us to a theme that maybe we'll elaborate on more later, but Pharaoh hardens his heart and God hardens Pharaoh's heart. You see that there's kind of both aspects of that, where Pharaoh hardens his own heart, but also God hardens his heart. And it does seem, one of the Jewish commentators said, it seems like in the first five plagues, it's more about Pharaoh hardening his own heart. But then after that, it's God hardening his heart. And it's almost the fact where, you know, he's hardened his own heart to the point of no return, I guess you could almost put that, to where ultimately it's God's sovereignty that's behind it, but at the same time, it's Pharaoh's own culpability for his own hard heart. So we'll probably look at that more as we go through the different plagues and we see that aspect of Pharaoh's hardened heart. But certainly, it emphasizes the fact that God is sovereign even over Pharaoh's heart, but yet at the same time, Pharaoh is culpable for his own hardening of his own heart. So you have both aspects of that coming into play here. And so, you know what will happen. Now, verse 24 through 26 is another one of these interesting sections where, you know, it came about at the lodging place on the way that Yahweh met him and sought to put him to death. You're like, whoa, what's going on here? Then Zipporah, which is Moses' wife, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet and said, you are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. At that time, she said, you are a bridegroom of blood, because of the circumcision. And that's the story. It's just kind of like inserted in here, and you're like, what's the point of that? Seems to, first of all, there's a lot of kind of interpretational things. It starts off with, you know, it came about his lodging, Yahweh met him, and you're like, who's the him? And it really could be either Moses or his son. But in one sense, it doesn't really matter. It really seems to be here that, you know, the question is, who is God going to put to death? Was God going to put Moses to death or put his son to death? Doesn't really matter. Because the point is, something very, very serious was going on here. What was so serious? He wasn't circumcised, right? And where did circumcision come in? Abraham, right? What was circumcision? What do we call it? The sign of the covenant. right? And so God is about to elect this people and to make him his nation, right? And here's Moses, the deliverer, who through whom God is going to save his nation, and his own son isn't even circumcised. And so, the point of this is very, very important. Obedience is important, but especially this sign of the covenant, this circumcision, that, you know, ultimately, to be a Jew, that's the sign that you are a Jew and that you are in covenant relationship with God. And so, this is like, God was going to, whether it's Moses or his son that he was going to put to death, he was going to do something very, very serious because of how important it is that God's people are in this covenant relationship and just the obedience that's required of God. And so there's, you know, the story itself is kind of maybe a little bit out of the blue, but the point, I think, is very, very clear that the obedience of circumcision, that faithful covenant obedience that God requires, which of course is going to be the whole law, which we see kind of laid out later in this book, is vital. Is absolutely vital for God to redeem and make these people his own.
Well, Zipporah wasn't of Israel. She was a Midianite.
Right.
Which is, isn't that modern in Saudi Arabia?
We don't know exactly where Midian is. But, certainly and that's even kind of the irony of it, is she even knew how important this was. You know, and knew enough of the fact that this was so important to God that she knew what the remedy was. And that it's pretty fascinating just in and of itself. And so we end this section by, you know, Yahweh saying to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. They meet, they kiss. Moses told Aaron all the words and what the signs that he had commanded him to do. So Moses and Aaron, verse 29, went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which Yahweh had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed, right? And when they had heard that Yahweh was concerned about the sons of Israel, that he had seen their affliction, they bowed low and worshipped. A great fitting end to this, that they see the signs, they see that God had sent his deliverer to redeem them from Egypt, and so once again they worship. So great, great beginning to this great book. Once again, you see God's power, you see his sovereignty working to bring about his plan to redeem the people of Israel from Egypt, to deliver them by his mighty right hand, to cause them to be a worshiping people, right? To cause them to be that people through which God was known to the world, and to be the light to the nations. We'll see that unfold throughout the rest of the Pentateuch. But great, great lessons here for us, right? The power of God, once again, the importance of obedience, the importance of trusting God. Remember that in God's timing, he hears, he cares for his people, right? And he acts on our behalf even, right? I love those words, God saw, God remembered, God heard, God visited. He uses those terms over and over to show that God cares for his people. You know, but once again, God calls for that covenant obedience, that faith and that trust that walks with him if the people of God are going to be used by God to accomplish his plan and purpose. So, once again, so many of the same lessons that we've seen already in Genesis, but now we're seeing them played out even more specifically as God is bringing his plan to fruition through the nation of Israel. So, any closing comments or questions? It's good to watch even the irony of how God foils Pharaoh's plans through a bunch of women who, you know, refuse to obey him and trust in God in various ways, and you know, to see God's power that's going to ultimately overthrow these cosmic forces of evil by his mighty right hand. So once again, just remember God's power that is still operative today in our lives. So, and even as Eric pointed out, just how God responded to prayer and the importance of prayer.
There's so many weaknesses that he admitted to God, and if God chooses him to glorify himself.
Yeah, and even within that, right, that Moses kept bringing it back to himself and God kept bringing it back to himself, right? And that's what's important. It's the power of God that works through us. And it's not about us, it's about him. So that's a great reminder.
Is there a quick answer to the fact that every time the land is identified, it's identified as the land of these people, these people, these people, these people, these people?
I hadn't really thought about that.
All these heights.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think some of the significant, when you said these people, you're talking about the Canaanites, Perizzites, yeah. I think some of the significance is remember the setting once again is the sons of Israel on the brink of the promised land about to go in and wipe out these people. And so it's the constant reminder that as they're about to go into these very specific cities and wipe out a very specific group of people, which is obviously a very tough command to fulfill in terms of wiping out of whole civilizations, that there's so much the emphasis throughout the Pentateuch of, you know, this is your land. God has given you this land, this specific land. And so I think the specificity would have, you know, given them some assurance as they went in to do a very specific task, that this was the specific task that God wanted them to accomplish. So I think that has something to do with it there. And that's why even in Genesis, you see like some history about the Canaanites, you know, about their wickedness and various things to really give that them, to give the Israelites that impetus, that boost to be able to go in and do what God called them to do. Yes.
He obviously wasn't Jewish.
No.
So what would be a priest of necessary?
Oh man, don't ask me that.
He wasn't so much of an expert in the world.
He was the Midianites were still descendants of Abraham. Okay. So I mean, were they worshiping the true God? Who knows? You know, I can't necessarily answer it. Okay. I don't know. Don't know. Yes, that's another sticky question that...
That's more Jewish by nature, or Hebrew at least by nature.
Yeah, I mean, of course the liberals go crazy with that, but I would just say he has two names. All right, we'll close in prayer and we can continue to fellowship together and meditate on these things. Our Father, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you for your mighty power. We're amazed at how you displayed your might, how you revealed your character. You showed these signs, and even as we're reminded, worked through Moses. And it was all about you and not about him. And so we're reminded of that. We're reminded of the fact that you call your people to worship you. You call your people to have faith and obedience to you, to be the people that you want us to be used by you to accomplish your plan in this world. We're reminded of the fact that there's a cosmic battle between good and evil, between Yahweh and the gods of Egypt, as we see here, and we see that you win because you are the creator, that you are in control, that you are sovereign, that you accomplish your plan, that you will fulfill your promises to Abraham. And so we just thank you for your faithfulness. We thank you for who you are and that we could trust in that plan as well. And that even as we see this plan unfold through the person and work of Jesus Christ, that we have the privilege of being included in that plan as well. So we pray that you would help us to respond in faith and obedience as you called your people to, and that you would work in us in just as powerful of ways as you did through Moses and the Israelites, because we know that you are the same God. And so we praise you and we thank you. We pray that we would live these things out in Christ's name. Amen.